Welcome to Optimal Insights. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Senior Vice President of Hedging and Trading Operations at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode.
Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome. It is a new week. We've got a great show for you today. And in the interest of making sure you know what to watch, whether you're an originator, a capital markets person, or just someone interested in mortgage industry and some great market commentary, keep listening in. Today, we're going to do market update. As always, we had some unemployment data last week. We've got some inflation data coming up this week. We'll also talk a little bit about what's going on or not going on with the war in Iran. After that, we will bring back an oldie, but a great one. We'll have James and Vimy on to talk MSR, so mortgage servicing rights. So we'll talk a little bit of MSR 101 and how that feeds into things like loan pricing and refinance recapture, and all kind of simplify the area around the MSR market. Before we get to that, just in the way of data, the OBMMI, the conventional 30-year, that sits currently at 6.3%. So still pretty elevated, higher than we'd like to see it. But as long as we've got this war happening and we've no real path or off-ramp to resolution, I think we're going to continue to see rates, you know, above that 6%. And then the 10-year at 4.4, so still relatively thin on the spread between those two. Less than 2% is what we like to see. We're about 1.9. So we'll keep an eye on that. All right, let's check in with James and Alex and get our market update. Okay, welcome, gentlemen. James, Alex, how's it going?
Morning, Jim. Doing well. How are you?
We have a new week. But first, before we get into this week, what happened last week? We had the big numbers. We had unemployment and a little bit of activity in the war in Iran, although it's starting to feel like Groundhog Day. Let's start with numbers. What did we see for non-farm? What's the unemployment picture look like?
Definitely. Non-farm is definitely the biggest number of last week. It was strongly to the upside. It was plus 115,000 versus an estimate of about 55,000. So, you know, kind of blew the number out of the water. Don't like to get too over our skis on these numbers, just because it is, at the end of the day, just a drop in the bucket. But looking through it, you know, the unemployment rate didn't change at all. Still sitting at 4.3%. But I like to see that it wasn't just all healthcare jobs this time around. It was only, you know, a third or so healthcare jobs that came in about 37,000, and then transporting and warehousing, which is usually the second runner up, that are construction jobs. They kind of trade places for second place. That one came in second place. So yeah, it was a little bit more of a balanced jobs report. But aside from that, I think the most outstanding part about it was that it was far better than the estimates were expecting.
Right. Yeah, we keep plugging along. Low unemployment rate, making a decent amount of jobs every month, other than a small negative number a few months back. We're still kicking. So it's, you know, it puts the Fed in kind of an interesting or kind of a boring spot where they, you know, unlikely to cut rates because of what's going on with unemployment and inflation, but unlikely to hike rates either because things are kind of, I don't know, still feel a little bit fragile on the surface, under the surface. What did we get in terms of Iran? Are we any notable changes there? I feel like every week it's just another negotiation or another negotiation that's terminated or thrown out the window.
Yep. Yeah, very much so the same this week. I think all of last week was kind of hyping up the expectation that Iran was going to respond to the U.S.'s initial plan. Their response was clearly not enough. Trump shot it down on Truth Social pretty quickly, saying it was unacceptable what they were asking for. So we're kind of back to square one. There's no active hostilities, at least between the U.S. and Iran. There's still proxy conflicts going on, and the odd drone goes up every now and then. But that doesn't seem to shake the foundation of the ceasefire itself into like an all-out shooting war like we saw back in March. But yeah, it does feel like on the diplomacy front, we're back to square one at the moment. I do want to note, you know, Trump is traveling to China. He's having a meeting with Xi Jinping. You know, Iran is typically, you know, they're not a communist country by any stretch of the imagination, but they are, you know, Chinese aligned. So, you know, maybe they can hammer something out between Trump and Xi in Beijing. I think that's kind of what people are waiting for at this point. But again, we're back to square one in regards to the Pakistani intermediated talks between Iran and the U.S.
Yeah, nothing. No big changes there. We still have expensive oil, expensive gas. I think, yeah, the average $4.50. That's about what we're paying here in Colorado. I was just in California. Whew. They're going to have to add an extra digit to some of those boards out in front of the gas stations. They're getting upwards of, you know, close to $7 a gallon in Southern California.
Yeah, no, it definitely feels like a who blinks first kind of scenario. Both sides seem to think that they have the cards. You know, that the U.S. is kind of banking on, I still think they're kind of banking on maybe some sort of regime change or a softening in the IRGC's positioning, while at the same time, Iran's kind of banking on, it's an election year. You know, Trump doesn't, he's being blamed for higher gas prices, and polls are showing that this conflict itself is relatively unpopular. So yeah, we'll have to see. Only time will tell.
Right. And meanwhile, there's, you know, a couple other wars going on. I keep having to remind myself of that. I was reading again about the Ukraine-Russia war and the amount of people that have been killed in that conflict, and just the undertone or the thought there might be a regime change in Russia here in the not too distant future. I think the people of that country are feeling like Putin maybe has overstayed his welcome in power, and I think a million-ish soldiers have died in that war, which is just kind of bananas, considering they were the invading party in that scuffle. So anyway, still a lot going on in the world, and like you said, only time will tell.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If it's anything like the closure of the Syrian civil war, it could be really fast after, you know, quite a long period of stagnation. So we'll have to see.
Right. All right. What's going on this week? We get some numbers. We get to see the rest of the picture, which would be inflation, the second half of the coin. For the Fed, kind of expecting higher numbers because we're getting probably now the full impact of the war in Iran and fuel prices, which, you know, are raising all prices, you know, across the board.
Well, we are coming back to inflation this week after jobs at the end of last week. We'll see on Tuesday, we'll see CPI. The expected value right now is going to be up 0.6%, which puts us at a total year over year of 3.8%. That's just the generalized number. It's 2.7% core, which strips out the most volatile piece right now being, you know, food and, of course, energy in the form of gasoline. As you said, California is looking at some pretty high gas prices. As this war continues, we may see this continue to see that spread between core and the actual number kind of continue to widen. We expect all goods, all services to slowly be pushed up over time. But if gasoline keeps on its kind of precipitous rise, that spread will continue. Wednesday, we'll come around to PPI. So we'll get to see where the inflation is hitting producers. The increase of 0.6% is the same, but overall PPI sits around 4% and it's 3.6% core. So it's much higher on the producer side, which makes sense. You know, over the past 2 years now, or a year and a half, we've been talking about the tariffs and who's been eating them. If the producer side of this has been taking a lot of the blow, inflation has been creeping up more than it has on the consumers. And now this is continuing to push them further up.
Right. So we'll continue to see, I guess, with fuel as well, if producers are eating some of that cost or if they're just adding it on to what they're charging the consumer. All right. What else are we seeing here? So we covered the meeting between Trump and China. Covered everything on inflation. Yeah, we're not seeing a ton right now, but I guess next week we will all be in New York City. So hopefully we'll see some of y'all there. We'll have some other discussion. We'll record another podcast leading up to that. We'll have some next week's numbers for you as well. All right. What else, gentlemen?
I think that just about covers it. I'm looking forward to seeing some folks' faces in New York.
Yeah, same. All right. quick and easy this week. Yeah. Thanks a lot for the info, Alex, James. Appreciate you.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. My name is James Cahill. I'm joined by Vimi Vasudeva of the MSR team. She's actually my boss. We're going to be talking MSR 101. We're going to be doing a two-parter here. First part is just an introduction to MSR. What are these assets? How should we think about them? The second part will be more, what does the MSR team do day to day, as well as how should we think about hedging these types of assets? So to start, if you price out loans or you're hedging or you think about profitability, you're actually probably dealing with MSRs, whether or not you really realize it.
Yeah. And James, that is my favorite part because people will often say, well, I don't really deal with MSR. I don't really need to understand this asset very well. And that's when I say, you definitely do. You just don't call it that.
Yeah. I've heard it said it's like taxes, right? You might not like them, but they're definitely there and you should know about it.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. But, you know, MSRs, they do show up in an originator's rate sheet. They show up in pipeline marks, which is best execution. They show up in retained versus release decisions. So even if you're not on the servicing side, the MSR is actually quietly influencing a lot of your decisions.
Leading into our first question here, I've been laughing at this all morning because, of course, I am on the MSR team underneath Vimi. So hopefully I could have been able to answer these. But Vimi, what is an MSR?
James, that's so funny because I was thinking about that. I was like, should we have reverse roles here so I can test James's knowledge? But I certainly don't need to. I know that you know all the answers. But yes, let me explain what an MSR is. And I should probably start by actually defining the acronym. I think everyone knows the mortgage industry loves a good acronym, but the MSR stands for the mortgage servicing right. What this really is it's a right to collect cash flows over time from servicing a mortgage. So this might be servicing a mortgage that an originator has originated or that an investor has bought. Either way, the owner of the MSR collects a servicing fee, so a base fee that they're compensated for servicing the loan. And since the servicer has to collect monthly payments, and as part of this duty is to remit the principal and interest part of the payment to the ultimate investor, also having to manage the taxes and insurance part of the payment, the servicer will deduct a fee from the borrower payment before remitting the payment to the investor.
So what is the typical servicing fee and how does that translate into dollars?
Yeah, so I would say the typical servicing fee is going to be anywhere between 25 and 50 basis points. For a fixed rate conventional loan, it's generally going to be 25 basis points. And what this means is you can think of it as a percentage, right? So 25 basis points means 0.25% of the remaining mortgage balance, also known as the unpaid principal balance, UPB, another acronym, 1/12 of which is paid per month. So to put this into a numeric example, let's think about a mortgage with a UPB of $100,000. The servicing fee is 25 basis points. And so this means that the servicer is entitled to retain the 0.25%, the 25 basis points divided by 12 times 100,000 UPB, which translates into roughly $21. And so what this means is that before passing on a borrower's payment to the final note holder, the servicer gets to keep that $21-ish dollars. And that's what they're compensated for. So that's the base income, right? But then, of course, we want to consider that there are other income opportunities with servicing. That includes the escrow income. So we talked about how borrowers have to remit part of the payment to taxes and insurance, but they have an opportunity to earn income on that part of the payment. And this has, of course, become a much larger part of the value in recent years, given the higher rate environment. There could be ancillary income. Let's suppose you're a bank with cross-sell opportunities. There's definitely opportunity to earn income by selling other services to the borrower, and, you know, a couple of other opportunities as well. But as mentioned before, the servicer is actually having to service the loan, right? So, of course, there are going to be some costs that come into play.
Yeah. So it's two halves. You have income and a responsibility.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It sounds great, right? Until you remember that you actually have to do some work.
Yeah, it's not quite a passive income stream.
Not quite. And the balance between those cash flows and the cost is really what's driving the value, and which is why it's such an important part of pricing and profitability, and so important for originators to really understand the value of the MSR.
So once now that you understand what the MSR is and the importance of pricing, what is it that actually moves an MSR value?
That's a really good question, James, because yeah, we can figure out what the value is now, but then how do you figure out how that value is changing over time? And I would say that the single biggest driver is going to be prepayment behavior. So when rates fall, borrowers are very likely to refinance faster, which means that the MSR owner's cash flows are going to end sooner, which then translates into MSR values going down. And then on the other hand, when rates rise, borrowers are likely to stick around longer, and so the MSR value is going to go up.
So in a weird way, MSR kind of likes it when rates are higher.
Yes, it's actually one of the few places in mortgage where people are quietly rooting for rates to go the other way.
careful, which audience you say that to. That's a heated item.
Yeah, right? Know your crowd. Okay, so beyond rates, we've got real world factors to consider, right? So things like delinquency, cost to service, escrow balances, remittance timing. And just to break some of those down, if delinquencies rise, a servicer's cost to service those delinquent loans is going to increase, which of course would pull down the value. We talked about the opportunity to earn income on an escrow balance when we were looking at the positive cash flows. But then again, in a delinquency situation, the servicer is on the hook to still remit that part of the payment to the tax and insurance agencies, but they're not receiving the payment from the borrower. So they're on the hook. That's a cost to them. So generally speaking, delinquencies are going to make servicing more expensive operationally. And of course, that's going to impact the value as well. So I would say in general, prepay is absolutely the steering wheel, and everything else is just kind of road conditions.
Ooh, maybe that's a good little line. I'm definitely going to steal that one for later.
Feel free to.
Within pricing, when you talk to MSR, everyone is always speaking about multiples. Can you define what multiples are and how we use them?
Yeah, sure. That's another important distinction for our audience. So an MSR multiple, you can really think about it as a standard valuation metric that's used in the secondary mortgage market. And it's expressing the price of an MSR asset as a multiple of its servicing fee. So technically, it's calculated by dividing the market value of the MSR, which is stated as a percentage of the UPB, the unpaid principal balance, by the weighted average servicing fee. And this is important, right? Like if someone might be asking, well, why would you do this? Why don't you just quote this in terms of price? But because there are varying structures in what the servicing fee could be, using a multiple provides a consistent, normalized way to compare MSR values or MSR portfolios across these varying structures. And so to get into another numeric example, let's consider that we have a portfolio valued at 100 basis points. And so it's 1% of the UPB. If in this scenario, the weighted average servicing fee is 25 basis points, well, that's going to result in a multiple of 4 because we're taking 100 divided by 25 and the multiple is 4. So it just provides an easier way an easier method for comparison.
Okay, yeah. So it's just a way to boil all the different loans down to a single number so that you could compare the valuations. So with that, now that we know, hey, what an MSR is, what's kind of moving it around and how we should be talking shop on it with MULTs, could you speak a little bit to retained and released, this concept that you hear a ton about over an MSR?
Yeah, for sure. So it's a good transition, James, because when someone is considering whether they're going to retain or release, it is really important to look at all aspects of the cash flows and, what does this mean in terms of what would my MSR multiple be if I were to retain versus release? So to answer your direct question, I would really say at a high level, you're looking at the value of income today versus the value of potential income in the future. And so if you release, you're getting paid up front, right? You're getting that cash immediately. There's no guessing about what's going to happen in the future. The servicing asset's not your problem anymore. It's someone else's. Or it's not your opportunity, I should say. But if you retain, you hold on to a stream of these future cash flows. And you've got to kind of figure out, what do these future cash flows mean for me today? How much can I depend on them, i.e. would the cash flow still be around if rates decrease because the borrower is more likely to prepay, et cetera? So lots of things to consider there.
Yeah. So really on the base, what we're talking about is instant gratification in the form of getting the cash right now, or delayed gratification in holding the asset and being able to service it over the longer period and getting cash throughout.
Yeah, exactly. I guess one could say that MSR is the mortgage version of, do I eat the cookie now or do I eat the cookie later?
I know in my household it goes quick. So
yeah, same. But right, so especially in, you know, a tight margin environment, such as the environment that we've been in for quite a while now, cash can be really compelling, right? Like, you want to sell the servicing to get the cash. But then you also have to think about, if sell that servicing, you're essentially selling the borrower relationship. You are giving up the opportunity to more easily get a chance to refinance that borrower when the borrower decides to refinance, because you no longer have that relationship. And this has been a really hot topic in the industry over the last couple of years, and we have talked about it on the podcast countless times, so we won't spend too much time today on that. But it's, of course, an important thing to talk about when you ask, how should one consider the retain-release decision? And then finally, of course, you do want to think about operational capacity, right? Do you have the capacity, or do you have the infrastructure to support servicing? And if you don't, well, then of course the answer there is that you should sell the servicing to someone else who can do that. It's not as simple as it sounds.
Yeah. So at the most basic, it is that, hey, do I need the cash now or could I have it later? But there's more to consider. If you're having the cash now, you're giving away the relationship, which that makes cash flows later of a refinance or a second mortgage, you're kind of selling that away as well. But if you retain, you need to have a team that's able to process that. So it sounds like there's just a lot more than just the easiest way of looking at it.
Yep, you got it.
Because I came from the pipeline side. So whenever I think about MSRs, I'm always looking at like LLPAs, and I'm going, okay, this borrower has a high or a low FICO score, so we are going to dink the price, or the UPB is extra high, so maybe Fannie wants it, but Penny doesn't. What are there any adjustments on the MSR side that would matter in the sort of way that an LLPA would on pipeline?
Yeah, that's a great question. So certainly there's going to be some overlap into what data really plays a role in driving the value or, you know, assessing the risks of the MSR. I would say that one of the biggest ones is obviously going to be interest rate, right? Because that's going to determine the likelihood to prepay. We talked about that being the biggest driver of MSR value. So what is my current note rate? What is the rate that is being offered out there today? Do I have a chance to refinance and save on my monthly payment? But of course, there are many other borrower-specific data points to look at to assess the propensity to prepay. So one of those would be state. There are certain states in which it's very unlikely for a borrower to turn over and get a new house or even to refinance the loan. Another one is going to be UPB. And this one, you know, is, as you mentioned, the pipeline side, James, this is a pretty big one on the UPB side, especially as of late with the introduction of new spec payups, but the investors and agencies are paying up for low loan balance loans, because those loans they're not as likely to prepay even if rates drop, because you only have a certain amount of money left, only a certain amount of obligation left on your mortgage. Are you really going to go through the effort of refinancing your loan? That would be another big one in terms of assessing voluntary prepays. Of course, you'd want to look at things like the borrower FICO and LTV to assess involuntary prepay. So that means to assess the likelihood of a borrower potentially going delinquent. So I would say those are some of the heavy hitters.
So it is kind of similar, right? Front end, back end pipeline MSR, a lot of the same fields, thinking about it the same way. What's really going on is these guys have thought about, well, how likely is this to prepay? And that's kind of part of why they're valuing it spec wise.
Absolutely. Yep.
Perfect. Well, Vimy, I appreciate the time. We'll be back for part two to talk a little bit more about what the MSR team does day to day, as well as how you might think about hedging an MSR. Thank you.
Yeah, it'll be my turn to ask you the questions, James. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, I'll be reviewing my notes.
All right, let's close this thing out. Thank you, Alex, James, and Vimy. Great show. Appreciate the time. Appreciate the knowledge. That's it for today. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thanks again for tuning in to Optimal Insights.